Hello and welcome to Kino Lefter episode 116. I'm your host, Evan, at McDonald Tweets. Thank you so much for tuning in this week. And I've got something a little bit different for you today. I know that people really love the interviews that get done on this show, and I think that this one is really special. So Talai Faulkner, game developer, has joined me to discuss his new game, Umurangi Generation, which is now available both on PC and on the Nintendo Switch. So you know that your boy played this game on Switch. I've been looking forward to it getting ported to the system for a very long time. This interview, there are going to be spoilers of the game. I really wanted this interview to be about the political text and subtext of the game. You have to play it. It's so good. This is an important thing. But yeah, we're getting into all of it. If you haven't heard of Umurangi Generation, it's a photography game set in the shitty future, wherein you work for a courier service and you have to take photos on a pretty tight deadline. And the world is also ending around you for reasons that we discuss on the show. I don't know if there's a specific line of demarcation in the episode for when spoilers begin, but they will definitely be in there because the game's been out since 2020. I highly recommend picking up the Switch port of it. There are also motion controls, so you can feel like a true gamer and a true photographer. So that's enough from me. And now here's Talai and I talking about this wonderful game. And I will be back with you at the end of the episode to give you your recomradation for the week and do my little sign off. All right, here's the episode. So I am now sitting digitally with Talai Faulkner, creator of Umurangi Generation. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm really good. Thanks for having me on.
Well, I'm very excited to have you on. I finished the game today, pretty much. I reached both sets of credits, and I completed the macro DLC on Switch. And I think maybe sort of a fun way to get into the interview. I got to like the end of the base game. Obviously, there will be spoilers in this conversation. Primarily, if you're interested in playing the game, I would say go and play it right now, and then listen to the interview. It was obviously a very powerful ending, seeing, you know, this creature in a devastated world and all of the symbolic resonance of that. And then I thought that the Gamer's Palace was this like beautiful piece of like post credit content or something, and then I realized I was just beginning the DLC.
And it's like with that, it's the kind of thing where like the Gamer's Palace is, and it's all the levels, like when you go back and replay them, you always pick up on what's the significance of that now that you've played the rest of the game. You know, the idea with the Gamer's Palace is about looking at sort of the comfort fascism enjoys in sort of the gaming or internet space. You know, where it enjoys the sort of, you know, the like nursing from like, you know, so-called centrists or whatever. And you can start to see that in the imagery. And like, once you've played the game, you can see why that's like there. Because we're talking about spoilers, obviously, you see like the sort of fascists in this case totally like, you know, exercise their power in a way to just keep the population under control. I'm really excited to have this conversation because, like, I think, you know, like I've always talked about this game is it's sort of a game in layers where, you know, the most surface layer is that it's a Jet Set Radio, Pokemon Snap, whatever thing, right? Like the aesthetic of it. But then, you know, a little bit deeper, it's about looking at neoliberalism and sort of, you know, the sort of politics around that, like with, you know, and doing it very, like, non-lame or very contemporary, like you know, I've read like, you know, Parenti and things like that. You know, it's this idea of looking at sort of how is like neoliberalism very comfortable to fascism, or how does that enable it, kind of thing. And you know, we've seen that play out like time and time again. And I think like it's one of those things I think about is, you know, we made it in 2020, but like you know, like all the fascism that was happening in America that spread around the world to other nation states, there were, you know, like the neoliberal system there allowed that to happen. And, you know, it's about putting it in the game, but putting it in a way where, you know, we're not really having those sort of infantile discussions around, you know, the stuff that YouTube talking heads talk about, but more taking it up a notch and being something where, you know, people who get this stuff can sort of consume it and have a good time with it. Yeah.
I imagined a player experiencing the game and particularly some of the macro DLC and going, ah, finally, a game without politics, just a fun, enjoyable photography game that reminds me of my favorite anime. And I think that there's so many things that I'd like to get into. One sort of particular experience I was left with the game is how you use humor as political commentary. I think potentially one of my favorite aspects of the game is just sort of all of the environmental storytelling that's done and a lot of the advertising, even in the Gamer's Palace. I think it's like Angry Man Child reviews in VR.
So get yelled at. I think it's just this whole thing where, you know, I think as we've seen over the, like, one thing I would say about this game is like one of the things I sort of took inspiration from was sort of like, I remember sort of seeing a thing about this sort of a while back, but it was sort of talking about how leftist cinema had a little bit of a golden age just recently, like with you know, movies like Parasite and stuff, where it was, you know, very overtly leftist movie, but most of that stuff is like hidden behind jokes or whatever to make it more mainstream appeal or whatever. But I think it's just the whole thing where, like, you know, especially when it comes to things like Angry Man Child reviews or, you know, like the fake Ben Shapiro's of the world trying to say the kaiju don't exist and stuff like that. I think it's just this whole thing where, you know, we as leftists shouldn't really give those people power by giving them sort of like a sort of even entertaining the ridiculousness of it. Like, rather should just point it out and laugh at it, because I feel, you know, it's this whole thing. The moment you sort of step into that court, you're stepping down what you can talk about. Like, you have to sort of now entertain stupid ideas, like that climate change doesn't exist or something like that. You know, like it's stupid. So like the point of that was to just sort of show the ridiculousness of it in the posters, so that like when you're playing it, hopefully you can see like how that lines up with sort of how you know, sort of far right or fascist people talk about stuff today. So like, with the game, the idea is that, so if you've played the game, because I assume some people don't care about spoilers and they just play it to hear the game is sort of like about what is the logical end of neoliberalism, and not end in terms of like getting rid of it, but how it's going to destroy the earth and everyone with it, right? And it's this idea that when players play the game, they're the Umurangi generation, they're the red sky final generation who watches the sun go down and then it's all over, right? And the idea around that is that, you know, you go through the base game and you see that there is a kaiju that has like come, you know, woken up from its slumber or whatever, and it's come to just completely destroy the earth because it's said, well, you haven't been looking after earth, it needs to like a reset kind of thing. And, you know, it's this kind of thing where it's obviously like a sort of metaphor for these like wicked problems neoliberalism creates with things like, you know, climate change or, you know, like capitalism or whatever. It's this idea that like this system destroys the earth throughout the game and you see the end. And then the DLC is set 2 weeks beforehand and you can see people still denying the reality of it. You can see them saying, oh, we're about to win this thing, we've got it under control. Or, you know, the kaiju aren't a big problem because, you know, we're killing less of them now, which means there must be less of them to kill. You know, it's obviously like a little riff on that. But the reality of that stuff is that I wanted to look at how this neoliberal script on, you know, when problems come up gets flipped every time. So, like, you know, with COVID, the same idea that we've all heard these same groups sort of talk about with, say, climate change, it's there, but it's just like they're swapping out the actors, which is, you know, they say it's a hoax created by China to stop manufacturing and, you know, you get the nationalistic thing, and then it's just this argument down the bottom that doesn't actually talk about the issue at all. And the idea is to say that whilst those people are bickering, the problem's still getting worse. And you know, by the time they even sort of come to a conclusion on that stuff, it's too late, right? And that's, you know, and I think, like, with the macro DLC, it was also about, you know, giving a bit of damnation to sort of, you know, sort of so-called left-wing liberals that, you know, claim to have this progressive attitude, but very, you know, almost reflexively ready to sort of arch their back over and defend the same problem still. You know, they're willing to defend these systems because they say, oh, it's just individuals, and if we had the right individuals in place, then it would just magically fix itself overnight. You know? And so that's that whole thing where, you know, you go to this place, the Gamer's Palace, and you see, you know, this aesthetic of resistance right next to a poster that's very, like, we love the cops, they're awesome, you know what I mean? And it's this thing where I feel like the next step, you know, and me and some friends are talking about doing this with the next game, is having critiques that are also for these people now that say, okay, it's now time for you to step up and go further than just this sort of put your hands in your pocket kind of thing. Like, I think one of the things which was so disappointing after Biden got in was you just saw all these people say, oh, I can't wait to not care about politics for the next 4 years, you know? And it's this weird admission of defeat, or that saying, oh, the adults are back in charge, you know, where it's this whole thing where people are now just willing to sort of, you know, let this same system keep doing as it's doing because they have, you know, a comforting face on it, you know? And so, you know, and the game's about that neoliberal comfort, you know, it's this idea that you go through the game and you see that there is this kaiju that is attacking the place and it's going to destroy the Earth by the end of the game. And you can see that this system has created comfort for people around that. They've done things like, you know, try to sort of incorporate it into marketing, or, you know, the rhetoric's changed where they don't say a giant squid monster thing is destroying the city. They say, you know, go to a quake shelter or something like that. You know what I mean? It's this whole thing where they're trying to make this thing very comfortable and easy to live through. And the idea around that is basically it's what we're seeing with, you know, climate change. You know, we saw it with COVID, even though COVID's not over yet. You know, it was this kind of thing where, and very directly with COVID, it was this whole thing where they tried to soften out and say we've got it under control, and it was really obvious for a lot of places they did. Or this whole thing where they don't call it a pandemic; they'll say, you know, something like social distancing, and I'm talking about this in sort of like marketing. You know, they don't say, get your food delivered because there's a pandemic. They'll say, practice, you know, I can't remember the word was, but it's like safe contact or something. But it was this whole thing where it was about removing the threat of the situation just to make it comfortable to live in. And, you know, that was the point of the game. And you can see towards the end of the DLC, it was about saying, now people are sick of this shit and they're going to protest, because there's this whole thing where you can see, throughout the game, there's this whole thing where you see the presence of the UN in almost anything. You'll keep seeing this property of the UN everywhere, right? And the idea is that you can start to see, if you look through the cracks, that the UN are killing people when they do these, you know, protection thing. But it's more often than not, it's poor people or, you know, indigenous people. And, you know, it's the people who live on the top side of the earth. They don't live underground. They don't live in the underground city where you don't have to worry about it. They live directly in front of the problem all the time. And so those people have gone to the underground city and they've said, we're going to protest this. And that's where you see the state step in to, you know, enact that fascist violence. Yeah.
And that was a particularly horrifying moment to end the game on. And I think that especially when the mech sort of comes down and obliterates everybody. And I think that it was an excellent choice to introduce the selfie camera after that, because a lot of the game obviously is about bearing witness and observation. And I was wondering how you could speak to the choice of making it a photography game, because I think it probably makes sense from a budgetary level and sort of making a game for a community of people who are very, you know, apt at making great art out of a video game that they're given, but especially for a game that's very much about responding to crisis or living in a moment of overlapping crises and potentially the paralysis of that, or maybe one of the only tools that people have is to, you know, observe in terror. So I was wondering what you were thinking about when sort of coming up with the verbs of this game or how players would interact with your story.
Yeah, so like it started not necessarily as, you know, this political razor or whatever to cut through a lot of stuff. It started as just I didn't know how to use 3D and I went, okay, I'll start with something simple, how to use the camera properly. And then it became, okay, we'll make a photography game, right? And then it was, you know, the sort of thing where 2019 was a mess for me, like in terms of a lot of stuff going on there. But, you know, it was this kind of thing where I feel that you can sort of start to create stuff that's, you know, not necessarily just the sort of game content. I had a chat with this guy called Dakota Baker, I believe his name was, and recently, and he sort of had this thing where he teaches game students, and he said, you know, if you're a game student and you're making games, don't just learn how to make games. Learn any fucking thing else, because if you only learn how to make games, your games are just going to be about making games. They're not going to be about anything interesting. And, you know, for me, it was like I worked at a university, and yeah, the thing about universities is anyone who's actually done, you know, any kind of political research eventually becomes a Marxist, because it's the only way you can stay sane at the end of all of it, because you start to see that this system is fucking broken. And the only, you know, critique that seems to actually be useful at doing this is one that's either, you know, a socialist or a Marxist critique. And, you know, it was this kind of thing where, you know, I'm quite new to sort of the concept of neoliberalism. Like, I think I started only learning about that in 2017, but, you know, the person who sort of walked me through it, he, you know, would do this sort of thing where he would, you know, because I would help him with his lectures, and he walked me through this idea of saying, what is the thing that connects the left and the right in Australia? And he would do this thing, and the students would sort of answer things like, they at first found it kind of difficult to sort of look at it, because, you know, oftentimes these partisan political systems, they sort of, you know, will have their policies up front that seem to make them very different. But when you start to look at the underlying assumptions beneath them, they're not really that different at all. Like, you know, one of the things, the only things I can think of in Australia was that at the time, the Labor Party, which was the supposed left-wing party that also axed all the unions in Australia, right? Like, they've shifted way further to the right than any left-wing party should. And the only real difference between them and the Liberal Party at that point was that they had a stance on gay marriage, which they had before when they were in power, when they never acted on that. And they also had a stance where they said, hands off Medicare, not like let's rebuild Medicare back up from all the times it's been stripped back, but we're going to not do anything to Medicare rather than just pulling it back down. And so, you know, it was this sort of thing where, you know, the students for a while were like struggling, and it was the lecturer there who pointed out it's neoliberalism is the thing that ties them together, because if you look at the foundation of all this, all the assumptions are the same, you know. All the assumptions about, say, for example, individual rights and stuff like that all line up exactly the same. And, you know, like with these political parties in Australia, they're all funded by the same, you know, mining companies and billionaires and stuff. And it's this whole thing where, you know, for me, it was this really big sort of wake-up call, because it was kind of like, you know, the thing I kind of think about is in Australia, Australia is like shifted to the right really far at this point. You know, in the 80s, Bob Hawke, who was the, at the time, or he quotes, at the time, left-wing political party, the Labour Party, that was where, you know, neoliberalism was starting to, you know, go around the world with, like, Reagan and all that. And in order to appeal to the centre, he shifted the party further to the right. And what happened there was that the, you know, the party moved to, you know, trying to appeal to the centre. And so what happened is that the entire Australian political landscape started to move further and further to the right. And that's why, like, you know, as I said, this Labor Party was the one that, you know, got rid of unions. Like, in Australia, if you're a union, you can't protest at all. Basically, you have, if you're a union in Australia, I'm pretty sure the ruling is that you have to ask the government, or no, not ask the government, you have to ask the employer if you're allowed to have a strike. That's how bad that is. And it's this whole thing where, you know, it was about like looking at this stuff in a way where basically the whole thing was like we could sort of make it plain and make it stupid in a way where you could sort of like get it. But like you could see that there was this problem that has infected this entire society. You know, the idea is there's these kaiju coming, destroying everything, and by the end of the game they destroy the whole world, right? And you know, this same neoliberal system has its hands in its pockets, and it's ready to just sort of focus on making people comfortable around it. And it's like, I guess the thing I kind of think of is, you know, I'm a millennial. I'm pretty sure you're a millennial. And, you know, this is obviously like Gen Z below us. But, you know, the thing I can kind of see now is that you have all these millennials at the moment who are taking the, or being sort of prepared to take the seat of this older generation who has fucked the world up and continue fucking the world up. And it's this whole thing where, you know, the idea with Umurangi generation was you are, or when you're playing the game, you're of that last generation who has to sit and watch. You have to sit and watch the world die because this generation above you has done the inaction, and they've let it get so bad that the world's fucked. And that's the kind of, I think, tragedy of the game. But I think it's the whole point is to say that is the path we're heading to. You know, and it's this sort of thing where I don't think you can change individuals to fix that problem. You need to change the entire system. You know, I'm sort of thinking about sort of like where people sort of have this idea that, you know, like if you put your recycling and stuff to the side, it's going to sort of enact a lot of social change. Yeah, it does a little bit, but in the grand scheme of things, it's pretty much pointless because like the system at whole is the thing creating the problem. And so like I kind of think that the main thing is that, you know, like it is a little bit like doom appealed at the end of the day, but it's this whole thing where I feel like you gotta do it truthfully and like not you know, soften that up or sugarcoat it. Like you don't have a part at the end of the game where, you know, basically you take a photo and then the whole world changes and everyone's good at the end of the day. That doesn't work because the whole point is to say that it is too late in that game, that nothing is going to come after the credits roll, right? And that way, like, you know, you can really, like, pull your punches. Not pull your punches. You can really, like, you know, load your punches and kick for the throat kind of thing. Like, you know, I think it's much harder to sort of, as people say, hindsight's 20/20 or whatever, but like the thing about the game was like it's much harder to side with these people saying shut up, stop complaining, and just let people do their job when you know from playing the game that the world in the game ends in like by the end, right? It's much mm-hmm. it's much much easier, I think, to sort of sit there and sort of like go through that. Yeah, sorry, I feel like I'm just talking way too much.
No, this is great. I mean, people hear me too much on this show, and of course, I'm interested to hear what you have to say about the game. And I mean, I played it, so I have my perspective on it. I was curious sort of how you deployed indigeneity in the game, because obviously a lot of the game is defined by these sorts of like, you know, there's both inaction from the state, but also this sort of like resilience or, you know, death from everyday people, from both kaiju and their own government. And I think you see a lot of sort of interesting stories being told, and, you know, street art and dance and everything else. So I was curious how you sort of use that within the game.
Yeah, so you know, I'm Maori. I'm from Ngaitarangi, which is where the game like sort of takes place in Tauranga, which is you know, within that tribal boundary. The idea of that is that, you know, there's a lot of conscious things that go into that. Like, one of the big things was putting stuff in there that was sort of like couldn't be stolen or misused, right? Because the sad fact is that a lot of times our stuff is stolen and misused. So that meant using patterns that were sort of you know, Raringa patterns that were pretty low risk in terms of, you know, if someone did something like that, or, you know, drawing icons and graphics and stuff that, you know, weren't necessarily tied to a specific place. And that's just the nature of the thing, because, you know, like within the first week of the game coming out, I watched a Twitch streamer who finished the game and he said, oh, I want to get a tattoo of this game, you know? And if that was, you know, the kind of thing where we put, you know, Mokko in or something like that, would have been pretty bad. The whole point, I think, of, you know, this sort of space for me was sort of about, you know, for me it was about building sort of my own self-confidence in the medium, but also like my own sort of, you know, like mana and stuff like that. But then it was like this sort of space where I wanted to sort of jump as far away as possible from sort of where you see a lot of Maori portrayed in games and stuff, or, you know, media. Because the reality is, like, a lot of times when we see, you know, Maori portrayed in video games, it's this sort of, you know, noble savage warrior stereotype on one hand. And then the other hand is you see this very edutainment type thing where, you know, it's this Maori person and they're, you know, wearing very traditional garb and things like that. And I think the idea was to sort of say that, like, you know, we still exist today. In this cyberpunk future, we definitely still exist. This is the problems that still exist. This is the problems that have come about that still exist. And, you know, it was about sort of moving in that space and moving in a way where you could sort of see that, you know, there was stuff there. So, like, for example, with the with that space, it was, you know, about also including characters that had fair skin. You know, Maori people with fair skin, because reality is this, you know, we exist. You know, and that's a byproduct of the colonization. You know, it's a byproduct of the last 200 years. And, you know, it's this kind of thing where you know, that's never been the point of being Maori to begin with. That's a Western idea. That's a idea that's come from these systems that have destroyed the world. You know, very famously, the blood quota stuff that Hitler used during World War II originated in Australia. And that was Australian or British people in Australia developing racial or racist science to dispossess Aboriginal people of their land. They were saying, oh, once they reach a quarter caste, they are no longer Aboriginal and they therefore no longer have claim to the land. And then, you know, the Nazi party went, that's a really good idea. We should use that. And obviously that's what happened. But, you know, we still see that effect today, which is this whole thing where, you know, the racism comes up as how Maori are you, or, you know, what percent. And the whole point of the game was to say all the best parts, you know. And that's what the Maori people in the game, they're from these different places, and you know, what you see them wearing is also a sort of look at sort of contemporary stuff, you know. You see one character and they've got sort of a bikey jacket on, and then you see another character and they've got a Captain Cook style jacket on, right? But it's obviously got, you know, paintings over it and stuff. It's really deliberate because, you know, there is this whole thing where a lot of times we have to put on these sort of, like, you know, Pakeha costumes, if you know what I mean, like in terms of the, got to put on this sort of thing where you have to sort of hide in plain sight. And, you know, that's a thing where, you know, my experience with that working at a university was, you know, at the time I just looked like a nerdy IT boy and they would say, oh, can you pack up the computer? We've got to leave this meeting. And everyone else would walk out and the group we were meeting with was still in the room having a chat. And I was just there packing up the laptop and they'd open their mouth in front of me and say things they probably shouldn't have because they thought, oh, that's not one of those Indigenous people. That's someone else, right? And it was a sort of thing where you can hide in plain sight with that. And, you know, that's more often than not. It's, you know, we exist. And it's just that whole thing where I think having that in the game and doing that is the kind of thing where, you know, might seem a little risky or whatever, but, like, it's the kind of thing where I feel having it in there and being able to sort of, you know, just exist and be Maori in that space is just one of the strengths of it. Because I guess there's that whole thing where, you know, I'm saying about this whole layered thing of the first thing being very surface, the second thing being this very like leftist critique of neoliberalism. The third layer is the Māori one, and that's the one that's hardest for most people to see. You kind of almost have to be Māori to see it, because it's this whole thing where it's just hidden in plain sight. You can see it if you know what's going on there. You know, you can walk into that space and know what's going on in that space if you see certain things. And, you know, it's that kind of thing where I think with stuff like that, it's the best way to do it, because basically it protects itself then. It doesn't become this open knowledge that anyone can just sort of siphon and use for what they want. It's just there, but it's not explained. Yeah,
and I think that's important to be cognizant of, especially using the medium of a video game, right, where almost the player brings a lot of their own maybe baggage, but like they, you know, can take this experience and go like, oh, that's mine, as opposed to, you know, investigating it and sort of experiencing it on their own terms. I was curious sort of about the use of the video game as a critique of fascism and sort of neoliberalism today, because I don't have to remind you, but video games generally typically are, you know, fascist power fantasies, and, you know, they're completely corporatized, and especially gaming under capitalism is a, you know, experience and sort of, you know, getting the same thing every year. And I feel like even in indie games, which of course I'm not an indie game developer, but I play them, you sort of see a lot of the same narratives coming up about, you know, fathers and sons, or very like intimate personal stories that are, you know, have very few mechanics to them, and then people can say like, wow, I had a really emotional experience playing this, it must be perfect. So I was wondering how what your thought process is when sort of thinking about, okay, I'm going to make this video game, when it exists in this ecosystem of you know, video games that obviously are not critical of the system that births them.
Well, yeah, I would just say, like, I think games in this weird space where, like, I mean, one, we all know that, like, and even to this day, but very specifically in the 2000s, a lot of government contracts from the, you know, DARPA and that went to game studios to make these, you know, like, you know, American Invasion of Iraq propaganda games, where it was about, you know, being this big action hero and whatever, right? Like, and very famously, I believe, the US Army started using, like, Xbox controllers to control, like, EOD drones and things like that. And basically, like, I mean, it's this thing where, like, I definitely agree with you about this whole, there is a connection there with fascism and sort of the game space. You know, that's why the Gamers Palace level is this whole thing where you see, you know, even very fashy slogans on the wall. Like, one of them's like, you know, no pussy shit, right? This is a real man's man game, you know, machismo stuff. And then, you know, like a level later, when you go to this like UN hangar, which is basically like, you know, this fascist incubator for all these child soldiers who are mech pilots to pilot the thing, you can see the same rhetoric start to appear on these, you know, fascist propaganda things that, you know, like, are you afraid of dying? Well, harden the fuck up, you pussy, right? Like, and it's this whole thing where basically, you know, it's about like looking at that. And I think like one thing I think about very, you know, clearly about is this whole thing where games as a whole have this very, like, it's very weird relationship when it comes to, like, say, fascism and communism. And you know, maybe it's because I've been reading a lot of Parenti stuff, but it's this whole thing where basically fascism, when it's portrayed in games, is given every out in the book. It's given this very comfortable space to sort of be fascist, and then by the time it gets to the point where you do the Scooby-Doo moment, you pull the mask off, it's, oh, he wasn't fascist because of the system, it's because he was crazy, or he was on drugs, or he was possessed by a demon, or whatever, right? Like, it's always this thing where it's, by the end, they say it's an individual that, you know, the individual was just bad, it wasn't, you know, necessarily the whole thing, right? Then you compare that with sort of how communism is usually portrayed in games, and it's just this Red Scare bullshit we'll see in, like, the last 100 years, where it's, you know, the whole it's either you're very direct, very cartoony, you know, Mother Russia bullshit, or it's your you know, Orson Welles, you know, Animal Farm smug, you know, you think that would work? Have you ever, you know, whatever, right? And then, you know, it's this really interesting thing, I think, because it's very obvious when you see that it's from people who have no idea about any of that stuff, right? It's just the same sort of tired crap that's been fed to people forever. And I think the whole point of this game was to sort of, like, let's take a little bit more of an academic look to it and explore the really interesting parts no one talks about. So, you know, when you start to see in this game, you know, the ads on posters and billboards and stuff, where they're talking about how cool it would be if you, you know, joined the military and sacrificed your life away. You know, and you can see, like, the recruitment posters through, like, VR and stuff like that. Or just the idea of, like, the nation building. You know, one of the things I looked at a lot was nation building, which is this whole thing about making homogenous citizens. And, you know, it's the sort of thing where nation building still goes on today. And it's the same bullshit that they pulled during colonization periods in the 1800s and 1700s, right? Which is, the first thing to go is language. The next things to go is, you know, spirituality and beliefs and stuff. And then it's this whole thing where the entire concept of value is reascribed to a population. So, like, you know, one of the first things that I remember when I was, you know, growing up, and when, you know, the Iraq War started, and they supposedly won that in, like, a couple of weeks, right? Remember, it was over almost as soon as it started, supposedly, was there was this whole thing where they were saying, oh, now they're printing new money. And on the money, they had new people's faces on it. The whole point of that in nation building is that you're putting value on the money and saying, this is what an ideal citizen looks like. So when you start to see that, it's this whole thing where basically, you know, in Australia, the money is this thing where you can point to things. Like, on the $100 note, the most valuable note, the common note, because I believe there's, like, $10,000 notes that you have to, like, specially order, and they're just for, like, show. It's this whole thing where, you know, the person on that is a opera singer, and the other side is an Anzac, right? And it's this whole thing where it's this whole Anzac myth coming into the money itself, because they're trying to sort of get Australians to believe the Anzac myth, right? The reality of the Anzacs in World War One was that a bunch of 18-year-olds went over to a country they'd never seen. Most of them didn't even know what their own country looked like. You know, they didn't even know what Australia was shaped like yet. And it was this thing where they all got slaughtered. And why? Because a, you know, like a monarchy to a country they'd never been to decided they wanted to send a bunch of troops there. The Australian Anzac myth is this idea that it's about mateship and gallantry and pushing through, and it's this total allusion to the reality of World War One. And so I think it's just this really interesting thing. So, like, you know, with the game, it was about when you go to this, you know, UN hangar, and you see your, you know, sort of finely dressed officers and stuff that sort of, you know, are there, and then you see the child soldiers and that, you start to look at what's on their walls and what's in the imagery and stuff, and you can see, you know, that whole concept of, say, like, rational fascism, or, like, the sort of, you know, oh, isn't it great that the person who's piloting this death machine is a woman, right? And hear her story out, right? Like, it's this whole thing where it's about softening that message and making it so people are not critical of it. And, like, I feel like talking about that stuff that's way beyond the sort of YouTube heckler stuff is the way to do it, because, you know, I don't think that many people are going to be as aware of that sort of stuff if they're very, like, you know, like, if their entire political consciousness comes from, say, Twitch streamers or, you know, YouTube videos. I don't think they're going to pick up on a lot of that stuff, because it's just this whole thing where I feel like a lot of those times those Twitch streamers or YouTube videos will start with something that is a very basic concept you learn in, like, year 7, and then they'll just go completely into the weeds of, like, weird hypothetical let's says and then things like that, where, like, the I guess the thing I just find that's very, like, hilarious about all that is basically these people are trying to redefine stuff that's already been defined for the last 60 years. And it's this kind of thing where if you do want to learn about how all that operates, just go read a book. Like, go get a JSTOR free account, 14-day trial, and go read through it all. It's all there, and it's all, you know, been analyzed to shit. And, like, you don't need to sort of come to these weird stopgap positions on it. Like, I feel one thing that was really obvious about last year with the protesting was you had a lot of these Twitch streamers who, you know, say they have left-wing audiences and stuff like that, where they would arrive at this conclusion where they would say, oh yeah, I'm for the revolution, I'm just not for the looting, right? And it was this whole thing where it's like, so you're saying that the price of the liberation of, you know, African-American people under the police state is not worth, you know, $2,000 getting taken from a store that's probably insured. And it's this whole thing where I think, you know, for me, it's like, well, how do I know if these people are sort of claiming to be leftists or whatever, how do I know they're going to be there for when the, you know, actual, in quotes, actual revolution comes or whatever, right? Like how do I know you're not going to just make another bullshit excuse like that? And I think it's just this whole thing where if you ever go and, like, read a lot of that sort of political theory, it all lines up to a space that's way beyond what people think is, you know, they're just discovering. I think it's also why, you know, when it comes to those online circles, they debate fascists on completely made up facts, because these fascists are getting, like I think it's one of these things is fascists are tending to read more than these internet leftists, where they're basically able to read internet leftist literature. They're able to read actual leftist literature, repurpose it as fascist literature, bring it to the internet leftist, and the internet leftist now has to critique something that they should probably be able to walk around very easily. Like, you know, an example of that would be this whole thing where in Australia or in Aotearoa and everywhere, you know, we've got our own traditional medicines that, you know, they work, because it's the sort of thing where it's like, what do you think paracetamol is made of? You know, it's made of poppy seed, right? What's a poppy seed? It's a flower, right? Or, you know, it comes from a flower. Well, there's actually more than one version of that kind of effect in the world. There's other plants and seeds and types of ways of healing things. And basically, you know, there are, you know, alternative, and I use that word alternative medicine, but very lightly, because I know that it's a word now that's been, you know, co-opted by conspiracy psychos. But, like, basically, you know, we have our own medicines that things that we've always done to say, you know, heal a broken bone or stop a flu or something like that, right? And your internet fascist has decided that they hear this term and they think, oh, witch doctors, they're just doing hoogie-boogie stuff. And your internet leftist, rather than going and seeing that that is a load of bullshit this person has made up, actually engages with it and tries to give the conclusion that, you know, the like, oh no, we should just let them have their you know, god that eats children, because it's just all they want. And it's like, how can you get ran around the ring so often with that? And I feel like I don't want to be too critical of you know, leftists who are just learning, but I feel like the thing I kind of think about is, like, there's a lot of leftists online who have, you know, ample amounts of time now to do research, but they just sit there playing Minecraft. So, you know, there's a bit of critique there. But yeah, that's my thinking around it. Yeah, sorry, it's totally gone way off. But
no, I love it. And they should be playing the correct video games, because then they'll be smart now. That's another brilliant joke from the environmental storytelling that I really liked. And I think there is obviously an issue with sort of like incommensurability with a lot of, like, socialist movements and, you know, liberation for indigenous peoples. I mean, that's especially evident in Canada when, you know, images of, you know, water defenders blocking a pipeline or something are, you know, all over the media of the military being sent in to disperse and arrest people who know for a fact that, you know, their lands and water are about to be poisoned. But, you know, Justin Trudeau is prime minister, so things aren't actually that bad, even though the machinery of empire still works very fine. And I think that the sort of, like, gap, it's a very strange gap, but obviously we live in a, you know, settler colonial system, and that's one of, like, the primary mechanisms of power in the West, and for that to be, you know, misunderstood, or for there to be such a lack of knowledge from people who should be engaging to dismantle that system. Because if anything, the end goal of any kind of socialist movement in a settler colonial context is aiding in that confrontation with the settler state in order to, you know, break that apart and, you know, come back to a more just political formation. And I think that sort of the, like you were saying, the illiteracy around those issues is particularly
the illiteracy
interesting.
And the aesthetic of it. Like, I mean, one thing I think is so interesting about, so like Parenti's work is like, you know, I think it's in Black Shirts and Reds, and like the first chapter, he talks about how like Benito Mussolini claimed to be a communist in his early sort of younger years, and this whole thing of revolution and all that. And it was just this thing where it's like almost on a dime, switch back around to being, or not switch back around, but, you know, just shifted just a little bit more to the right and became this, you know, fascist, like, not overnight, but like, I believe he was always in there, but just the aesthetic of it. And I think it's this whole thing where, you know, like, I guess the thing I kind of think about is political theory is not really that hard to digest anymore. Like, in terms of, we're in the internet age now where, you know, you can pirate any Warner Brothers movie or video game or whatever, right? You can definitely pirate a PDF of a book if you really can't afford, say, like a $14, you know, set of basic works to begin with. And, you know, there's also, like, the whole thing is that, you know, nowadays, like, when I'm busy and I've got to be working, I'll put on an audiobook in the background. It will always be, like, you can go to YouTube and find so many audiobooks of, you know, things that are out of print where you can, you know, like, just listen along. And I feel like it's just a sort of thing where, I don't know, I feel like a lot of, it almost feels like, you know how you always just get that shift of the center? It's like a metronome almost sometimes where everyone decides they want to be right wing, and then everyone else decides they want to be left wing, right? And it's this whole thing where, you know, I feel that there's this whole thing where I feel like a lot of this internet discourse sometimes it just, it is so aesthetic and performative that it just like, you know what I mean? These people don't have a conviction to it. Like when you were talking there about the, you know, indigenous people protecting their land from, you know, the government coming in and destroying it, or doing the same thing that they've done for 200 years, which is give it to an oil baron or whatever to exploit. You know, it's this whole thing where to some of these people, because they don't have the literacy around it, they just see someone standing there and the police asking them to move, and then the police, you know, running them over and being like, oh, well, you should have moved, you know what I mean? It's rather, like, they can't see the actual underlying sort of stuff underneath the surface of it. Because, like, I feel it's just one of those things where basically, like, I feel like this is the biggest hurdle, I think, a lot of times, you know, socialists or whatever have to think. It's just almost like you're speaking a different language to someone, because there are so many assumptions people need to come to before they can sort of see what's going on there. Like, you know, the big thing I kind of think is that you need to explain to them what neoliberalism is. You know, for a lot of them, they look at politics as that, you know, political alignment chart, you know, whereas like when you start looking at neoliberalism, it's like you're Bob Ross saying they're all just a little mistake, you know what I mean? In this wider tapestry of the neoliberal thing, right? And, you know, like explaining to someone, this is neoliberalism and it's bad. And then, you know, and like I remember my friend who was this tutor had to explain this to me a couple of times. He said, no, there's no good in this. You know, there's the aesthetic of good, like in terms of there's things like the partisan, you know, say like a Justin Trudeau or whatever, where he's so good for whatever, right? There's that aesthetic of it, but the underlying stuff is all broken, right? It's like it's the whole thing where basically and now is just a system for the rich, right? And it's that whole thing where you need to try and explain to someone what neoliberalism is, and that's probably the hardest step of them all. Because I think once you can explain and understand what neoliberalism is, because, I mean, it's that whole thing where a lot of people think liberal means leftist or left-wing. And it's the hardest thing to get across to people. You know, the easiest way I've explained it to people is I said liberals in Australia are a right-wing party. Like, and I mean that very specifically, they are the conservative party to the Labour Party. You have liberals and Labour, right? And they go, oh, that's a bit weird. How did that happen? And then you start to explain to them, no, 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 it's the set of assumptions beneath it and all this stuff, right? And basically, it's one of the hardest things, I think, to explain to people, because once you can get them to start to see this stuff as, you know, a thing that's working, you know, underneath all of these partisan, you know, political groups, then they can start to see that it, you know, it is a system, and then they can start to sort of look at, you know, ways of critiquing it. And that's where I think it's much easier for people to sort of start to look at, you know, like say like the works of Parenti or, you know, I sometimes hold off on telling people to read Marx because it's that whole thing where Marx the individual is very like, I don't think his critique, like he has a critique of now the individual, but this Marxist critique is applicable to now. You know what I mean? Like,
mm-hmm.
you know, Marx didn't imagine, you know, this sort of space at the moment where it's like the entire media landscape being owned by one person, you know, which is Rupert Murdoch, an Australian citizen. The story behind that being that he's an Australian citizen and an American citizen, like a dual citizen. And because of that, he could own pretty much all of Australia's media and pretty much all of America's media. And so, like, this is kind of what I mean when I said earlier about, like, America sort of having this flow-on effect of its fascism around the world. Like, you know, it was sort of unthinkable in 2013. People would be supporting, like Australia got its Tony Abbott, right, who was this, I mean, it was this sort of thing where the inept Labour Party in Australia, they kept swapping the prime minister position, right? Like, you have a prime minister system where you can do a spill motion and you can swap your leader out, and basically you're just changing the face and getting a new honeymoon period for your party to continue the exact same policies of the last whatever, right? And so Australia had this guy called Kevin Rudd, who you know, he won in 2007 against Australia's longest running prime minister in total, John Howard. And it was this thing where basically he got sort of a little bit too, like, I'm not saying he was progressive at all, but he basically said, maybe we should do a mining tax. And all these mining companies who own the entire political system said, fuck no. And they got those sort of, you know, they got a spill motion happening. Because, I mean, I think the thing people don't realize is a spill motion is quite easy to do in these things. All you need to do is, if you're a, you know, like, mining company or something, or someone in the party who wants to take power, you just need to go to all the people who are, you know, little no names in swing seats and say, you're going to lose your job at the end of the year unless you do this bill. Oh, I don't want to do that. And then you get your 11 signatures and then you can do it, right? And basically, it made this thing where they had all this momentum on it. And you know, Tony Abbott, who was a national embarrassment, still is, got into power, made himself a national embarrassment, got replaced in under a year, because he just kept doing stupid goofs. And it was this kind of thing where I feel almost bad for Tony Abbott, because if he had done that in 2015, he would have probably got the same track record as Trump, as being this, you know, big hardline guy on immigration and all this stuff, because he was just as ridiculous, right? And it's this sort of thing where, you know, it was unthinkable in 2013, 2011 for anyone to be watching Sky News, because there are a bunch of losers who, you know, no one gave a crap about, right? And now in Australia, basically Sky News is on free-to-air TV, and it's full of your, you know, right-wing hecklers who are talking about, like, I think the one that made me just, like, cringe to death was, it's a 65-year-old shock jock guy, and he says Snowflake and SJW on national TV, and I'm just like, that's how fucking bad it has gotten in this landscape, that these, like, idiots are, one, they're able to keep their jobs because they're funded by Rupert Murdoch, the richest guy in the media landscape. And, you know, it's the sort of thing where basically they're able to sort of grow this giant audience because, you know, like, even though it feels so prevalent now, you know, I can still remember when no one talked about fake news and no one was super skeptical of the media. The only people who were skeptical of the media were usually people who were like leftist, you know, university lecturers who were critical of things like, say, for example, like critical of, you know, all the stuff that was going on during the 2000s with, you know, like WikiLeaks and Edward Snowden and that. But they were saying, this is, you know, whatever. And it's the sort of thing where I feel like even today, it's that whole thing of fascists co-opting a message. They've taken the words and terms that everyone has sort of heard in sort of, you know, osmosis around, like, things like, for example, all the WikiLeaks and Snowden stuff and, you know, media literacy and all that. And they've taken that, and now they've just reapplied that to anything that's not within their, you know, basic circle of, you know, like Fox News or whatever, right? And it's just really, I think it's just such a, like, it's such a, I think it's fucked. It's a fucked thing, and it's like this whole thing where I feel, you know, with games and stuff, like, sorry, we'll make this about games again. We're not just going to do a basic political podcast, but, like, I feel like with games, there's, like, so much to talk about there, but games just rarely do, because it's this whole thing where basically it's way easier to just write a, you know, 1980s B-movie script and make it about this evil boss that you can beat at the end, and then it's all good. Like, I feel there are a bunch of games I can think of that went so close to talking about something like this, where they had this wealth of stuff to explore, and then they just sort of dialed it all back and then just made it this, you know, like, same old. And, like, I feel, you know, I'm sort of in pre-production on my next game, and the idea around that is basically it's going to be a sort of, you know, like one of those movies where there's a crew of people and they slowly get picked off one by one by a monster. But the idea is to say that the crew is all going to be different, you know, political ideologies, a lot of them being, you know, liberal political ideologies, but also, like, you know, you have your, like, the thing I'm sort of thinking is you have people on that crew that are also just checked out because they realize it's all a scam, right? Like, one of the ideas is sort of like, you know, there's a trans character we're writing, and it's just this idea that they've had their entire body replaced after, you know, a, like, wartime injury, right? Like, they've been severely hurt, and the procedure they did in the hospital was to replace their entire body, and because they were doing that, that person could choose the body they actually wanted, right? And they regrew it in a vat and then transferred it in and whatever, right? Like, basically, they have the body they want now, but you now see that it is, one, they're in medical debt, two, there's, like, you know, this whole thing where the system still hasn't changed. You know, there's still this thing where people are finding excuses to discriminate against that person. And, you know, it's this kind of thing where one of the writers on the project is trans, and we're going to be, you know, taking a lot of that stuff and putting it in, you know, from this way of, let's unpack what this stuff is. Let's not make it just a little tokenistic thing that, you know, the trans character has their 30-minute trans montage and then they're back to just being another person in the story, you know? Because I think one thing, and just to cap that off, is basically that person's checked out because they can see that it's broken, right? And you can see that they will tend to associate with other characters who have checked out, and it's the reason for things like, you know, one of the characters is you know, Indigenous, and they got told to fight this war for Pluto, and by the time they got back, their entire place had just been bulldozed over and skyscrapers had been built there. Because it's that whole, you know, it was never serious to begin with, right? And so, basically, the idea is, like, with that game is to go knee-deep, or not knee-deep, but, like, almost neck-deep into what's going on in that political system and what's, like, what's going at play there. Like the idea we have with that is, like, you know, the captain of the ship is your... like you said, like, you're sort of Justin Trudeau or Joe Biden, where they're the happy face on a completely butchered system, which is that for the game, you know, we won't get into sort of the world-building stuff there, but basically they're this whole thing where they trust in the process and they trust in the system that currently exists. And, you know, oh, when you have a problem, just follow procedure and it'll all be fixed by the end. And then you see that the next in command, the warrant officer, is your sort of fake leftist, or you know, the sort of you get those people who call themselves, I believe it's a Sock Dem, which is you know, the whole thing where they say, you know, they still have this thing where they'll bend over backwards to defend capitalism, but they basically just want a European style, like, you know, healthcare system or something like that, right? They don't actually want a system change. That's this whole thing where a lot of the times their progressive politics end up being very performative, and it's this whole thing where, you know, we want to show that this person agrees with the captain 99% of the time. And on the few things that they do disagree on, it's barely anything of note that's going to be, you know, the kind of thing that actually accomplishes much. Like, the idea we have is that basically they have a few disagreements with individuals on the ship, but in terms of how they, you know, do the sort of like rest of the stuff, it's all good in their eyes. And it's this whole thing where I feel like making that the character and being these characters of critique where you can start to really explore them through the game, I feel is it's one of these things where I don't feel like you can really do that justice with like a movie or a book or whatever, because the idea with this game is that whilst you're also doing this, it's a like horror movie equivalent where there's a thing trying to kill the rest of the crew, and you can start to see that when these people are put under stress or when they are faced with a decision, what do they actually align up with? And the idea around that is, you know, one of the gameplay mechanics is going to be that moment in a movie where, you know, everyone has the sit down and they figure out what are they going to do, and it's that whole thing where, you know, they all vote on it and someone will get outvoted or whatever. And the idea is that when you play the game, you're just one of the crew. You don't have the be all and end all say. You basically you can decide something, but the crew can all vote against you depending if they don't like you or if they look at you and they don't like your political ideology. Like, one of the ideas is that say for example, one of the characters on board the ship is a communist, right? And it's this thing where we see that that very like paternalistic complex a lot of these liberals have to people who are different or can critique them, which is this thing where they say, "Oh, I agree, we should do that," and then it's the and now I don't want to talk to you anymore. You know, as a you know. Indigenous person, I've seen it hundreds of times where there's this, you know, kind of thing where, say, for example, elders will give a suggestion on something, and you'll hear someone say, "That's such a good idea," and then they will still go ahead with their own idea anyway. So, like, you know, it'll be something like, for example, one of the elders might say, "Don't build something there because you shouldn't." Like, it's, you know, a site that has a lot of history to it that wouldn't be appropriate for this. "That's such a good idea. We'll take that into consideration." They just go ahead with it anyway. And it's just like, it's just this kind of thing where putting that in the game and making that the characters, I think, can be this really enjoyable thing because it makes the characters, one, like, interesting to sort of be around, but two, it's also like, I think, with the game itself, you start to see that, like each of the characters also has a, you know, a technical aspect when they're alive that is part of the game. So, like, you know, if, say, for example, the, you know, engine room maintenance guy who's very, you know, blue collar, but he's, you know, like a, I wouldn't say nationalist, but, you know, he's a salt of the earth, you know, no bullshit. I'm sick of all this, you know, fancy schmancy, whatever, right? He's the only guy who can repair the ship, but he also might have the kind of views and opinions that are repulsive, right? And I think it's this very interesting thing where you can have all these people in a place, and I think when players will play, it's this whole thing where it almost sort of, I think, diagnoses their ontological perspective, because it'll be sort of like, well, how valuable is that person to use skill versus their, you know, what they say and believe. And I think you know, like I'm thinking about games more from that perspective, where, like, you can do these kind of things where they meld together a lot of these more interesting topics. And, like, if you can do that in terms of, like, doing that with the gameplay, I feel like it can be the sort of thing where, like, you basically are able to sort of walk players through a thing and see, like, okay, this is actually what's going on here. Like, yeah, I don't have much to really say more than that. I do have a lot to say about that, actually. Like, I've got a 60-page document that we've been working through, but I don't really want to give away the surprise of what that game's going to be, other than I think it's going to be the kind of game where people are going to have, I think, a pretty fun time just, like, walking through that one and taking their time with it. But, yeah, we'll see whether that one comes maybe next year or year after that. Really depends, I think, on, you know, how that all goes. But, you know, my thinking is with games is to do them, you know, smaller ideas and do them well or as well as you can, and then ship them and get your sort of critique and feedback, and then move on to the next one rather than trying to make a magnum opus with barely any money. So that's my thinking.
I won't ask you too many. I won't ask you any questions about the next project. I'm extremely interested in it. I'm a big The Thing and Alien fan, and from what you're saying, I kind of get shades of that. But
I think one thing about horror that I think a lot of people don't realize is it is a very inherently political genre. Like, every horror movie in the 50s was about communism. And then when you started to get to the 70s and 80s, they were blue-collar movies about people being disposable. Like, you know, the famous line from Alien is crew expendable, you know, and it's this thing where, or like in The Thing, it's that, you know, very Reagan night thing where everyone doesn't trust each other anymore. And I feel like, you keep saying your question, but I feel like it's the right fit for it is to do it in a horror game, because it's where I think those ideologies get stressed the most, because they start to have to make decisions that are, I guess, political decisions. They have to make decisions on who to keep alive or who to side with, or, you know, what should we do, right? And I feel like especially that what should we do thing is something that we see, I think, quite a lot in political spaces, just with, like, you know, like, for example, even when the protests were on, everyone had a different hot take around that, and the what should we do about that. You know, with Umurangi, the idea was to say, let's actually listen to what the community's saying in these areas, and also relate it back to, you know, like indigenous resistance and historic resistance and stuff like that. And what is the response of the government? The government's response has always been, they'll break their own rules to get their own way. And so that's the idea around that. Sorry, you go back to your question.
No, I appreciate the interjection. But the thing that I'm curious about, and we could talk for a very long time, but I will have to cap this at some point. As a means of ending our conversation, one of the things that I was most receptive about with Umurangi Generation is sort of how dense with meaning it is, and sort of how deliberate all of these spaces are. And now that you've had a chance to sort of revisit that game with, you know, Macro and porting it to Switch and moving on to this next project, how do you feel like, maybe not that you're a different artist, but what have you learned sort of after all of this process, and how do you feel like that's going to translate into the next project?
I think there's like one thing I would say is that, you know, going all the way full circle back to the start of the conversation about, like, you know, Parasite and this new golden age of leftist media, I think that there is definitely room to create this kind of media, because it's like, there's people who are hungry for it. That's one, you know, so you don't have to be starving on the street at the end of the day. But, like, two is, I think that having these staged approach to the topics, so starting with an introduction and then moving up a little bit and introducing the ideas as it goes, I think is a really positive way of getting people to start to learn stuff. So in terms of the kind of, like, you know, game space or the internet space where people are talking about this whole thing where sort of people don't learn the proper analysis of things, and then they get the, you know, they'll Google, like, for example, I would assume, okay, and maybe I'll test this out just so I'm not an idiot, but if I was to go onto YouTube and just say, like, why did Rome fall, right, I would assume that I would probably get a bunch of videos in there that would say the reason Rome fell was because of degeneracy, and you know, that but basically it was what's happening now with leftists or something, right? You wouldn't actually get a historical interpretation of that. And I think it's this whole thing in games where basically if you went to talk about these sort of more political topics and you are introducing them from the very get-go, from a different origin point, you know, like, I think one thing that you've really got to do around all this stuff is, like, let's say, for example, if you're introducing the idea of, like, let's say, like, Indigenous rights or something like that, if you move as far away from possible as the current school curriculum and you start from a position that's much more strong, because I feel one of the things school curriculums are great at is they're basically very good at giving this weird half and half approach where, you know, for example, in Australia, the school curriculum was rewritten to, quote unquote, not have a black armband view of history. So it was very nationalistic and you can't critique the government. And any bad stuff that was done by the government was a mistake, wasn't intentional or deliberate, which is complete bullshit, right? Like, you know, it's the sort of thing where people will say, when Indigenous people were massacred, it was because they were trying to soothe the pillow of a dying race. You know, that's the line they will say. And basically, that is completely inaccurate. The reason Indigenous people were massacred in Australia was because Europeans saw that there was all this land that they thought they could farm on, and they wanted to dispossess and take that wealth for themselves. There's no other way of looking around that. This is not a accidental genocide, you know what I mean? And it's this sort of thing where, you know, going into these games, I think that you've got to stick to your guns and not do this weird centrist bullshit. You've got to actually push back against that stuff and explain it correctly, and correctly from a position that isn't, dude, trust me, it's got to be this sort of thing where you can show a very clear example of where that is happening to then communicate your point. Like, you know, the thing I would think about is, you know, like if you're, say, going to talk about, like this game that we're sort of working on at the moment is going to be talking about this whole thing of, you know, American forever wars, you know, or this idea of the exponential imperialism that, you know, keeps going over and over again. Like the same systems of, you know, invasion, decimation, and domination that we see today in the Middle East or wherever, or let's say, for example, the Gaza Strip. They're the same things that these systems have been doing for the last hundreds of years. And it's not necessarily sometimes even America the one that's doing them. It's the ones that America learned how to do them from. You know, very famously, the US was like, you know, after World War II, they got all these scientists and all these Nazis to come over and join their ranks. And I don't think that's the kind of thing where it's this sort of thing where they put them in a shower and scrubbed all the Nazi stuff off them, because you can't. That stuff is ideological. Like, it's beyond something that you can get rid of with words alone. Or you know, like you can't take that out of like certain ideological or systemic things. And so, like, you know, with this game, it's about, like, for example, the idea of the game is it all takes place in a post-war period after the US has just fought a completely meaningless war for Pluto. The only reason they wanted it is because they wanted to say they owned Pluto as well. And it's this kind of thing where basically you can start to show that this is not a new thing either, that they've done this over and over again to basically do this kind of stuff. And, like, I think I don't want to spoil the main hook of the game, because definitely probably showing something like that off in the next, I don't know, 6 to 8 months or something. But, like, basically the idea with the game is that, you know, when you play it, you'll see stuff that I think, like with Umurangi, makes it plain a lot of the time, and it makes it this kind of thing where you can start to see what's going on under the surface with a lot of the characters, or looking at the relationships, but also sort of like, what are those characters sort of like? You know, like, one of the things we were sort of joking around with is that, you know, this fake leftist, and I'm not talking about you, but this fake leftist in the game is going to have a podcast called the Black Rose Podcast, you know, because it's this sort of thing where it's that kind of type of person. I don't know if saying people who own podcasts of like leftists or anything, but, you know, it's the sort of thing where you see, you know, what are they talking about on it? Oh, well, it's about them still sort of saying it's so good that, you know, the adults are back in charge, or that the system is going to finally fix itself and real change and all this crap, right? And I feel like it's just this kind of thing where, you know, I still want to do sort of the minimalist world building, or not minimalist world building, but the minimalist dialogue in terms of not having a lot of it spelled out. But, you know, I feel it's this kind of thing where it's going to be a bit of a juggle to do it right. But, you know, it's about stepping up and doing something a little bit more each time. And I think with Umurangi, it was, you know, enough of a little success for me to sort of like try out environmental storytelling as opposed to traditional storytelling. And I think it seems to have had an effect on people, because I haven't seen many people walk away from that unless they had a real big axe to grind, who didn't get it towards the end, or at least walk away with an emotional connection to what they'd experienced. Yeah.
Well, I appreciate our conversation so much. This was very fulfilling to me. And listener, if you haven't played Umurangi Generation yet, you can do so on your PC or the Switch. Thanks so much for coming on. Where can people find you on the computer?
So you can follow me on Twitter at Vasilikol. You can follow the game on Twitter at Umurangi Game. And basically, yeah, like Umurangi probably in the show title and stuff like that, but get it on PC and Switch. As we're recording this, we're just rolling out a patch to the Switch version, which will let you take higher resolution photographs and a couple little bug fixes there. But I prefer to play on the Switch, because when you play with the motion controls, it's like holding a camera. So yeah, I'm excited. But yeah, thank you for having me on today.
And that was my interview with Talai Faulkner. So everyone, go show your love to this game. You have to play it. If you've been paying attention to the indie game scene of last year, you've probably heard of it. And I hope you're as excited as I am about his next project. It sounds extremely good. And I know that the audience of this program would be very interested in playing a video game like that. Now, I have one recomradation for you this week, and that is The Black Coat's Daughter from 2015. This is a horror film directed by Oz Perkins, who I know did something in Mean Girls. I think they were an actor or something in Mean Girls. I can easily look this up, but I refuse to. Maybe it was Legally Blonde. I think it was Legally Blonde. So yeah, you shouldn't really look up anything about The Black Coat's Daughter before watching it, but it is a great atmospheric sort of slow burn vibes oriented horror film. So, you know, I'm very much into something like that. And if you haven't reviewed the podcast, you can do so on the podcatcher of your choice. Also, a much easier link to do that will be in the episode description from now on. I figured that would be handy for you. And also, links to our Discord and Facebook communities are also in the episode description. If you haven't checked out the Patreon, you can go to patreon.com/KinoLefter. There, this week, you will find the second-to-last Saw episode, where Ferris and I talk about Saw 5 through Jigsaw. And then we're going to be talking about Spiral in the main feed soon. And yeah, bonus episodes there weekly, including our Planet of the Apes series, Takes from the Forbidden Zone, and Battle for the Planet of the Apes is coming up pretty soon, and I'm quite excited for that. But that is going to do it for this week on Kino Lefter again. Mad props to Talai for coming on the show. I loved talking with him, as you can tell from the episode. I think we had a lot of interesting things to discuss. And yes, I will talk to you through your podcatcher of choice next week. Bye-bye. Kino Lefter is a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. You can find great leftist Canadian podcasts like Big Shiny Takes, 49th Parallel, Le Plancher de Vache, Habiti Please, Alberta Advantage, Tech Won't Save Us, and The Progress Report on the network. To find out more and become a supporter of the network, head over to harbingermedianetwork.com.